Recorded live at 1BBSCon, August 1993 in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Tape number BB70. The Government, the Internet, and the BBS. With Ann Wells Branscombe.
On the Government, the Internet, and the BBS. My name is Lance Rose. I'm one of the people that has helped organize this session and this show. And it is my great pleasure to introduce Ann Branscombe. Ann is an attorney, a communications lawyer at Harvard University Program on Information Resources Policy. She has been very influential and involved in government and internet issues for many years. As chairman of the Communications Law Division of the American Bar Association Science and Technology Section, she edited a work called Toward a Law of Global Communications Networks and organized a number of research and professional educational projects. She has served as a member of the Commission on Freedom and Equality of Access to Information and as a consultant to the World Bank, National Science Foundation, the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment, and the State Department. Anne holds degrees in political science from Harvard University and the University of North Carolina and is a graduate of George Washington University Law School. She is also the author of an upcoming book called Who Owns Information, to be published by Basic Books in the fall of 1993.
Thank you, Lance. And I thank all of you who had a very long day for persevering and coming to this session. I must confess, I am probably as confused by the title of this session as you may be, because I didn't learn what it was until last night.
This is extemporaneous, is that right?
This is more or less extemporaneous. I came with a very large manuscript, Vince, on legal issues related to cyberspace, generally. In any event, I'm going to discuss the topic that I have been given, as it a certain lack of communication, because Lance and I did earlier discuss whether or not I would like to make a single presentation or appear in a panel, and I said I would much prefer to do something all by myself. But what I received from the conference was permission to participate on the legal issues session tomorrow morning, so I thought, well, that's fine, that's easy. Just field questions, which is probably what I'll end up doing today. Because what I'd like to do is share with you some of my concerns about the way public policy is moving in terms of the way different segments of the industry are operating and their aspirations, because we are seeing a merging of all different types of communication system into a digital system in which it's a little confusing as to who has what turf. Now, if we look just specifically at the title which I've been given, which is the government, the internet, and the BBS, I was trying to say, well, now what are the differences between these three words that I've been given? The government, by and large, has been a source of public funding for putting together the interconnection, which is the internet, which permits all sorts of users of information or people who want to exchange information to share it. The government is also a public information provider, and it is, and many of the agencies are now beginning to set up bulletin boards of their own and using it as a very useful mechanism for distributing information that is their mandate. The government is also a source of rules and regulation governing our collective lives. And, of course, as a lawyer, that's the area of government that I'm most familiar with, and particularly the judicial decisions and the legislative process and the administrative rules that come out of agencies like the Federal Communications Commission and the Federal Trade Commission. The bulletin boards, in which I have taken a very substantial interest since the very beginning, really come out of the private sector and from a very private orientation, and when they first appeared on the scene, I thought, well, this is a very interesting development because this is something electronic that really looks like the cork bulletin board on your refrigerator. And when people started raising questions about whether the First Amendment applied and what you could put on the bulletin board, it seemed to me that this was a very private area. We have Supreme Court decisions that say a man's home is his castle, and therefore you should be able to exclude from that castle whatever you like. So that it seemed to me that only rules determined by the host would be applicable in that environment. But then as the years went by and I discovered that something called FidoNet, which I went to a session this morning to learn more about, that electronic mail is being exchanged all over the world, and this becomes a public function, which people outside that private area begin to be concerned about. And then this morning I went to a session, and on the back of the T-shirt of the person who was making the presentation, I read the following, which says, "To do really cool things in the field of computerized communications and make a buck at it." Well, that means that the bulletin boards, rather than just being a private discussion among a closed user group, are really becoming commercialized and seeking to make a profit out of it. That's exactly what's happening at the opposite end of the spectrum with the government turning the internet piece by piece into a more privatized environment. And the people who have been on the frontier of internet uses really are very concerned that they're going to lose the culture of the internet, which has been one of the major advantages of the internet, has been a shared information environment in which people really work together to try to collect public domain information and exchange it. And it's been a very free-going atmosphere, and one in which there's been sort of an assumption that if you put something on a list server in the internet, that it's really anybody can take it and use it for whatever purpose that they like. That's not the way the copyright laws work. And as these closed user groups are beginning to mix and mingle with the geographically and territorially governed areas, we see a clash with the existing laws and how they apply to what lots of people would like to say, well, this is really something new and different, and established laws should not apply. I'd like to just mention the other things that I think one has to keep in focus, because I've been to several sessions today which are looking at the uses of the GIF images. We're beginning to... What has been a text-oriented system is now beginning to introduce video material and even voice material, which begins to look very much like telephones or cable televisions or television stations. These are the very entities that are also beginning to see opportunities in the text-oriented delivery of data, so that I think we're beginning to see, I mean, after all, the television, they've been trying to make some money out of video text unsuccessfully for years. But we are beginning to see these simple areas that we have pigeonholed into particular areas of the law getting all mixed up in a big bundle so that we don't know what anything really is or which rules apply. So we are converging into a really massive information marketplace. And in Telluride several weeks ago, David Hughes came down and said it was his purpose to interconnect all 5.5 billion people on the earth. And there were several of us that looked at David and said, "David, that boggles the mind." And when I went to a session this morning on the use of the e-vote, and the young woman was pleading with us that we had a small window of opportunity in which everybody would be able to participate in decision-making if we could only adapt this e-vote to our whole global system. The concept of these 5.5 billion people all using the e-vote to determine the great issues of today is it's an astounding challenge, and I think one that is not going to work out in the near future. I think I've been involved in a conference called a Law of Cyberspace, in which a whole bunch of lawyers have been trying to discuss whether cyberspace is a place which can, in fact, promulgate its own rules, and we've even discussed whether or not there should be a constitution for cyberspace, and there is no consensus on whether or not this is a good idea. One group saying, well, of course, I mean, one has to have a constitution in order to establish the basic rules in which we operate, and others which think this is complete nonsense and would wreck the whole freedom of cyberspace, which really operates very much like the frontier, in which there were cowboys and Indians, there were the sheep herders, and there were the cattlemen, there were the people who came in, the miners, and the people who wanted to farm. And in some states, for example, you have to fence the cattle out, and other states you have to fence the cattle in. So it depends upon, you know, which group got the upper hand in terms of deciding what the law should be in that state. And eventually the marshals came in, and if the people didn't like what the marshals did, they threw them out of town. So I think that's what's beginning to happen in cyberspace. But I don't think cyberspace is a place in which there will be a constitution for all of the electronic environment in which messages are exchanged or in which teleconferences take place, because there are many cyberspaces and there are many different types of users. And as the groups sort themselves out, we are seeing all sorts of different levels of distribution of information, from very private user groups, corporate bulletin boards in which you operate within a very closed system and the corporation makes the rules. However, the users are asserting their own ideas about how these systems should work. I think that what we will see in the near future is that like-minded peoples will tend to congregate. In fact, I'm not quite sure what the birds of a feather group is going through the session, but we certainly find that's true. I just went a couple of weeks ago when I met David telling me about how he was going to get all 5.5 billion of us online. We were looking at Telluride and how it was trying to develop an infozone and make itself into a high-tech node that would have access to all of the wonderful things that are out there on the internet, which I must confess, Vince, I too have difficulty finding. But a number of the locals came in and they said, well, you know, we sort of tried to go into the internet and we sort of look and we see all these strange things and all this strange conversation and we don't know how to participate and we find all sorts of things that are very foreign to us and we really sort of back out. So I think there is a real real cultural difference between those who are sort of in the system and feel comfortable with it and those who are still outsiders and watching and waiting to get in. But as the number of people who are coming online continues to proliferate, we will certainly see people sorting themselves out according to the groups that they feel comfortable with. And I have discovered that there is something, civilized communities like to establish rules, even if they don't become laws. There is something on the internet called netiquette. I understand there are very elaborate rules that people do conform to, and therefore we are beginning to see very established rules taking over. It's not the sort of free-flowing space that it has been in the past. I think that law really represents that consensus that is built up from building netiquette and what people are comfortable with and what they find that they can get away with but without other people seeing that they're stepping on their toes. And what we have now today in the information marketplace is really a trade in what I call information assets. And information has really become the coin of the realm because some of us give it away. Some of us trade it for a fair value among user groups. And some is sold at market prices. So I think we have to do away with the fanciful notion that information wants to be free, which I hear bandied about at lots of conferences, because information has no volition of its own. Facts are free, if you find them. But the aggregating, organizing of facts and putting them together in a manner which is useful to the end user is a very expensive, labor-intensive, and requires a lot of ingenuity to make it into an item in which people can use in their own workplace. So as we move from voluntary rules to codes of ethics to contracts, I think as long as we stay in our own small user groups, we have a reasonable amount of autonomy in making the rules we want to live by.
It's when we meet the geographical authority and someone outside the system is harmed that the rules of the territorial authority come into play. So the terrain really is as varied as the earth itself. And I would like to go over some of the areas that bother me. I know at one of the first conferences that I attended that the National Academy put together last fall, Jack Rickard came and he sort of looked at all the lawyers and he said, look, you know, we don't want to hear from you because the minute the lawyers appear, a bulletin board is dead on arrival. Well, I think that it's very troubling that one takes that attitude because if people find that they have been harmed in some way, they will call up their lawyer. We are a very litigious society, and will take you to court. As was it Lee Noga who was saying this morning, she had learned by litigation how the system works, and she would be glad to share it in terms of the things that are prohibited in the area of pornography. But I'd like to share with you, and then I hope that you will share with me your concerns. There are five or six areas I would like to point out in terms of cases and legislation that I think present tremendous obstacles for the sort of health of this information marketplace. And the first is the case, the Feist case, which you've probably heard about, which the Supreme Court handed down, and Justice O'Connor wrote the decision 18 months or 2 years ago, it has been now. But over the years, the courts had been trying to develop a theory called the sweat of the brow, that where the copyright law did not seem to apply to a situation in which factual material was put into a database, that if there was a substantial amount of value added and sweat of the brow in this work product or information asset, as I would like to call it, that they would permit recovery of a judgment when this was misappropriated by a competitor. The Feist case is sort of held explicitly that facts are not protectable and only expression is protectable under the copyright law. I made it even more complex by suggesting that this is constitutionally mandated. Actually, I think the case was poorly argued because telephone numbers are not facts. They're a very complex method for establishing access to electronic space. I mean, there are area codes and there are 700 numbers and 900 numbers and we're changing them and different countries have different numbers. So I think the lawyers, I hate to criticize, I hope there are no lawyers here from Kansas. It was a Kansas case, was it not, David? That perhaps they conceded that telephone numbers were facts. So I think the case might have been won on a different basis. But it's very troubling for information providers whose major value added is in the organization of facts. And I think in most of the computerized databases, the bulletin boards, that is the case, that there's not a lot of original expression that is really subject to the copyright law. In the European community, they are moving in the direction of trying to establish a proprietary rights in databases that would be independent and separate from the copyright law. Now, the second case I'd like to mention, which I think is also troubling, is the CompuServe case, Covey versus CompuServe, which held in effect that an entity like CompuServe is a distributor of information and not a publisher, and therefore not responsible for the content of the message. They were more like a newsstand, where you can't expect the person who is the entrepreneur who is providing access to a lot of different newspapers and books to have read every newspaper and book on the newsstand, and therefore they've not been held responsible when someone was harmed by a libelous material that was in the book. It's troublesome because it suggests to some extent that if you don't monitor the bit stream that you are making available, that you may not have any responsibility for the content. I think it's a troubling case because it was not a bulletin board case. It was a case involving a large information provider that has many, many subcontracts with the information providers who themselves are publishers and who have the legal responsibility for the content of what they are putting into that distribution system. So I think it would be unwise for bulletin board operators to rely upon the fact that if they just don't monitor what's in the traffic, that they may not be held liable if there is defamatory material or obscene material which state law can reach. I think we are going to have to worry about what law should apply to bulletin boards and what kinds of bulletin boards may be given some kind of insulation, because a bulletin board, well, there are many different types of bulletin boards. And I think so long as bulletin board is one which looks more like the cork board on the side of a refrigerator, that perhaps whatever you bring into your own home or your own bulletin board and whatever is discussed within a very private environment, and if you can assure that it is a private environment among a peer group who approve of their own rules and regulations, that perhaps the outside territorial law may not reach. I think once it becomes a commercial service, or if it's open up to outside payment for services, that one must be much more cautious about the manner in which one permits willy-nilly any kind of message to be placed in the system. And one of the things that comes out of that is the question of how you decide what kind of system you have. And I think it's very important that once user groups reach some kind of consensus within their own environment as to how they wish to behave or what is considered acceptable behavior in that environment, that it be made very clear to other users who come in under what circumstances they are entering that particular space. And I think this is one of the reasons why an entity like Prodigy has suggested that they are more like Disney World, that if you go to Disney World, you sort of expect it to be a family experience that you can bring your children and not expect them to be exposed to material that you might find objectionable. Now, the third area I'd like to mention is a little more complex one in the sense that it refers to an international treaty. Several years ago, the United States decided that it should enter the Berne Convention. You know, prior to entering the Berne Convention, U.S. copyright laws required that there be a notice on material that was copyrighted, that it was copyrighted, and the date and the entity that held the copyright. So you had a notice on the material that this was something copyrighted, and therefore it came under the rules and regulations that required that you be concerned about infringement and obtaining a license or a permission of the copyright owner to use this material. The problem with Berne is that the international rule under Berne is that there shall be no necessity for a copyright notice. And the U.S. law now requires, states that material, the copyright, starts from the time of creation. Prior thereto, if you issued something without the copyright notice, it became part of the public domain and anybody could take it and use it as they liked. Now, with the computer, even if there is a notice, it's easy to remove it. I think there are genuine problems in the electronic environment, particularly in terms of knowing when something is proprietary and when it is public domain. And in the freewheeling environment that we have operated under within the Internet, and I think in most teleconferences on bulletin boards, one sort of assumes that if it goes into the system, it's there for the taking, and it's something that nobody really cares about exerting proprietary rights and receiving compensation for. As we move more and more into a commercialized environment, it becomes more necessary to know when something is proprietary and when you must have permission to reuse it and incorporate it into another work of art or another literary piece or another posting or another what. Therefore, I think it's very important probably for user groups to decide on their own how they are going to establish the relationship under which information is released into an electronic system. I think when and if one is going to charge for reuses, you have to have electronic audit trails that will not only track that something is considered to be proprietary, but how it's going to be metered if it's used by other entities. And I think this is an area which technologically it's possible. I believe, Vince, am I correct that we are quite assured that the technology can cope with sorting out identifying marks? And I believe that in some of the computerized images that it is possible to embed messages that cannot be cut out in the pixels. I'm not an expert in this area, but I'm told that that it is possible to do so. Now, another area which I find very troubling is the what is happening with computer software and the applicability of the copyright law to computer software, and I'll tell you the reasons why I am concerned about it. There are several concerns. One is that when you are using any one of these electronic mail systems, it would be very nice if there were compatibility of the user interface. I find it extremely troubling in the middle of the night, particularly when I'm trying to log out. I use a fair number of different types of commercial systems. I use Lexis, I've used the Dow Jones, I use CompuServe and Prodigy and whatever. And I cannot remember, but since I jump from one to the other, whether it's LO or slash, or whether it's exit or quit or SO or whatever. And inevitably I'm sitting there, you know, paying. The meter is running and running while I'm trying to figure out which way to get out of the system. So, I mean, there for many reasons, I think user comfort and the health of the information marketplace really depends upon moving toward standardized user interfaces. The copyright law is moving in exactly the opposite direction, because we are saying that in order to protect your proprietary interest in the commercial value of what you have developed, that it must be as different as possible from any other piece of software. Now, the opposite thing is happening, which is very interesting. I mean, one can change the law. It may be difficult, and there are many established interests that make it complicated to change the law, but if people care enough about it and see it as an obstacle, the law can be changed. Now, the other thing that's happening within the software cases is expansion of the fair use doctrine to include what we call reverse engineering. I think this is also troubling because, and it is a result of the desire of users to have more compatibility and for systems to be interoperable, because any network, in order to function, you have to be able to move material across different gateways. And there are many different providers using different systems. In order to accommodate the need for interoperability and interconnection, the law is now moving in the direction of saying that it's fair use to go in and to decompile one's code in order to understand how it works, in order to be able to write an interoperable program. Well, this seems hardly fair to the person who developed this, and this was something new and unusual and different, and is an information asset which theoretically has value, that we are now saying, because it's so important in the public interest that we have interoperable systems, that we won't compensate these people for what has in fact been used. So I have been proposing that copy is not a very useful legal term to apply to computer software and network systems, because we copy everything. I mean, you take a disk, you copy, the first thing they tell you to do is to make an archived copy. But in order to use it, you're making copies all the time. It seems to me that if you have an information asset which is new, different, and useful, that we need to devise mechanisms for compensation for the use of those information assets. Now, there's one other area I'd like to mention, and this is the whole question of privacy, confidentiality, and identity. Because in the Internet, I think when they were discussing what cultural values might be lost in the privatization of the Internet, was this question of being able to enter anonymous messages. And I know that there are a number of sociologists that feel that it's extremely important for somebody to assume a different persona and try it out. There are reasons in the law why we protect anonymity for political purposes, because in authoritarian systems we've discovered that if your identity is known, it may mean death. So you remember the Chinese had the democracy wall for a long time, in which anonymous messages could be put on the wall, and eventually the powers that be decided that that was enough of a threat to do away with the democracy wall. On the other hand, if you want to establish responsibility in the legal system, which is what we require a publisher to be responsible for the information that they are putting out into this marketplace, you need to be able to identify the source of the message. And I know that the well apparently starts out with a message on screen that all users are responsible for their own words. Now, whether or not this legally will prevent them from prevent the system from having liability for the content remains questionable. In fact, even in the public broadcasting system, when the stations put on programs, they always put a little statement that this is solely the responsibility of WGBH in Boston or wherever. But in fact, the law says that the broadcaster is responsible for the content, so I doubt seriously that that waiver will keep them out of court, although it may keep someone who reads it from assuming that that's all right. That may be the direction one wants to go, but I think one has to think very carefully about whether or not anonymous messages should be permitted. And there is a compromise position, which I think was proposed by Murray Turoff and even Sarah Kiesler, who believes that there is some psychological value in assuming a different persona, that the systems operator ought to know that you may have a space in which you permit anonymous messages and permit people to assume different stances or try on different personalities, but that the system operator should in fact know who that person really is. Now, there's one story that was told to me by Sherry Turkle, who has been doing some research on bulletin boards, which I found rather amusing. I gather there was a session yesterday on women and bulletin boards, which unfortunately I didn't attend, which also discussed some of these problems. But this was a bulletin board in which was dedicated to a discussion of women about women's issues. And one woman on the, allegedly one woman who was involved in this conversation, was a disabled person who was completely bedridden, and all the women took great interest in her welfare, and many of them had become very close friends electronically and sort of had shared their innermost thoughts and secrets. And then when they came to the place that this person lived, they wanted to go visit her. Well, it finally turned out that this woman was a male psychiatrist. And the women in the system were absolutely incensed. They felt that their privacy had been invaded, that this was a terrible situation, but they did not know how to handle it. But I think we have to begin to worry about when and how we permit anonymous messages and under what purpose. But I think what we are really looking toward is information autonomy in the user groups in these various cyberspaces, and a new law that will govern the trading of information assets in this marketplace. We are worried about privacy, we're worried about confidentiality, we're worried about the integrity of the message, we're worried about group autonomy, because we have ethnic groups that want to be able to protect their own religion or their own cultural roots, and it's certainly possible within the electronic environment for people of like minds, of like cultural values, to deal with each other in a purely equitable basis and a peer system in which they establish their own rules, so long as they don't contravene the outside rules. And I think that's where we're going to see the problems arising in terms of uses of the systems. But so long as we do not contravene the territorial mandates of the established geographical communities, I think we can promulgate our own protocols and our own codes of ethics. We can establish our own contractual relationships, and it's important to do so. And indeed, I think we can develop laws of cyberspaces. Now, if you would share with me some of your concerns, I would be delighted to know some of the major things that that are on your mind. In fact, it's not widely known that the telephone systems do have the authority. In cases of harassment, they will monitor the message and they will identify the caller. Did everybody hear the question? I guess for the purposes of the tape, this is a question of whether or not the bulletin board operator really has the resources or the motivation to monitor comments that are placed in the system that may cause ultimate disaster on a third party. I think this is the reason I was suggesting that I think it's important if you're operating a commercial system with open access to a lot of people that you have to have established rules that people who are coming into the system understand and abide by. The larger users are in fact establishing rules and saying, if you come into this electronic environment, this is the way. These are rules we apply. You do this in countries. I mean, if you live in Saudi Arabia, you live by one set of rules, and you live by another if you live in Norway or Switzerland or the United States.
It's a lot easier, though, to weed out messages, perhaps to catch somebody's message that's going to affect the security.
I think the area of securities is particularly sensitive, and I think we may see, I think we will see a fair number of cases coming in to the courts. Correct me if I'm wrong, David. There have been cases Green Moss is one of the cases. There's a case involving Dow Jones, I think, in which we are beginning to see cases in which information that's incorrect has caused substantial damage to a business, and the person entering the message or the system carrying the message has been held responsible. I don't think you can completely, wash your hands of that kind of responsibility. Perhaps it's a matter of an educational process of the people who are entering the system that they should beware if it's an open system of what they're saying. If the statement is made in a private environment, it would not be a litigable statement. I think we'll take the questions from the microphone since we'd like to get on tape the question.
Vince. Thank you, Ann. I'm Vince Cerf. Actually, I have a long list of questions. I won't ask all of them.
Thank you.
but maybe some other time by email. First question has to do with electronic mail and contract policy. What, at this point, can we say about the nature of commitment that can be made in the event that an order is placed using electronic mail or other kind of apparent commitment has been made? Does the law speak to this yet?
Well, they're very elaborate committees and commissions worrying about electronic data interchange. The question arises with signatures on facsimile messages, for example. I mean, how you authenticate the fact that a contract exists or a meeting of the minds has occurred. It's my understanding in many cases that if you have two businesses that are trying to deal with each other, that they may have a written agreement that discussions that are made electronically can be considered to be part of the contract, and they establish the fact that they can deal with each other in the electronic environment.
So if this is by agreement, they would implicitly pairwise decide that this electronic exchange is therefore binding. Let me follow up just one more thing along those lines. Let's suppose that, in fact, one of the bulletin board systems is used in the course of a business transaction. And let's suppose that the business transaction later fails to materialize in the fashion intended, and one party wishes to litigate another on the matter. What happens to the bulletin board system? Is it required in any way, shape, or form to record and make available under subpoena the exchanges that have taken place? In some mass communications markets like public electronic mail services, there is a requirement to retain the material for 6 months or more. What about the bulletin board systems?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I think that the if the material were archived, it certainly would be could be made available under a subpoena for production of information. Yeah.
But is there any theory that says the bulletin board operator
has to archive it? Not to my knowledge.
Okay, I have lots of others, but I'll step aside for the rest of the party here waiting.
All right.
My question has to do with anonymity. As a system operator now, I am having troubles with anonymous mail generated on other systems, in fact generated out of the United States, coming onto my system. And as I understand it, the volume of anonymous traffic has taken off to the point where it is now virtually impossible for anybody operating an anonymous remailer to trace. That is, as I understand it, 5% of all messages posted on the Usenet are now traveling through anonymous remailers. And so my question is this. It is also theoretically possible by going through two of these anonymous remailers to be completely untraceable. What recourse, if any, do we have for this, given that it occurs outside of national boundaries, that traceability may be theoretically infeasible? And that these messages can be public.
I had a discussion with Ellie Noem about this in terms of the use of the telephone and the question of caller ID and anonymity. And he tells me that it's perfectly feasible to screen out anonymous messages if you don't want to receive them. So it seems to me that this is one way of doing it. I mean, if you've permitted your system to receive anonymous messages, then you run the risk of
containing
them on the system.
Is that individuals have referred to people on my system on messages that have gone into the Usenet in ways which they consider to be offensive, and that has those messages. In fact, someone went so far as to create an entire Usenet conference devoted to offending this individual, and that new group creation message was validated by 2,000 systems worldwide and is now part of the alt hierarchy, and probably will never go away. And you'll notice dozens of these groups for various purposes.
Well, I say, I don't think we've reached consensus yet on how to handle anonymous messages, because I think there are just as many people who feel that anonymity has value as there are those who feel that it has considerable dangers. And I think we have yet to sort out under what circumstances anonymous messages should be permitted, or whether you should be responsible for anonymous messages over which you have no control. But I would love to know how some of the rest of you feel about this. I mean, you've had more experience with anonymous messages than I have.
I guess I'm sort of on the same topic, that I'm looking at running a board that would be for one profession. So everybody on there would be a professional. And I'm really concerned about the potential for slander. At the same time, you don't want to restrict your users over much. The way I'm looking at it, you don't want to be interfering in their conversations. How do you tell when something has reached a point that, oh, this is slanderous and this, or libelous, and that, you know?
I think if you're dealing with a professional group, the professional groups usually have their only norms about, you know, what's permissible and what's not. In fact, if you go to a conference in England with a bunch of English academics or professionals or politicians, charming but devastating manner, and it's considered perfectly proper.
But part of that is the English tradition, like in Parliament, in English Parliament they have a tradition that goes back hundreds of years of saying absolutely horrible things to each other in public and making it part of the public record.
Right.
In the United States, we don't have a tradition like that, and I'm really concerned about this
issue. Well, we have a tradition like that among certain groups. I think it depends upon what's considered acceptable behavior in a particular social milieu, and different professions have, and different people have different standards. I think the problem is where you have mixed groups from all different types of backgrounds who don't understand each other and don't understand their behavior. And for some reason, which I haven't quite understood. The electronic environment seems to remove a lot of inhibitions for people whom, if you met them in the room, they would never say to you what they will say electronically. You know, I think we have yet to develop what's considered polite behavior electronically.
Well, is the onus then on me as SysOp to determine what...
I don't think when you're dealing with a particular user group, I would let them make their own rules. I mean, it's an established peer group of professionals. I would think they would want to make their own rules. And will. I mean, in many of the electronic conferences, I mean, flaming, I gather, is one sanction in which people apply if they find someone behaving in a manner they consider unacceptable. In many cases, on some of the networks, if there's one person who dominates the whole conference, the rest of the people just migrate to another conference and leave them all alone.
What about the legal...
So people will develop their own ways of handling these things.
What about the legal implications for me or liability of it or for any SysOp in a situation like that? The mechanisms you're talking about, I can see where those would be terribly effective, but they're not going to happen instantaneously. Some of them might take a while. There might be somebody who gets slandered who gets really upset really quickly, and you have to do something right away, I assume, or you become liable for that.
Set a standard for your system.
Go ahead.
Set a standard for your system, make it public to anyone who uses your system, and stick to it. So, you know, it all depends on exactly what environment your system is and what that standard has to be based on the profession involved.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think that's what I was trying to say earlier, that it's important for whatever system you're setting up for you to decide are you providing an adult, service under very special rules and preventing children from access to it, or are you providing an electronic Hyde Park corner? What are the rules you're setting up for that system so that people are warned in advance what electronic environment they are treading upon?
I guess one of my concerns is how law can operate against, you know, when the networks cross, you know, city, state, and international boundaries, how can any local law actually hope to deal with a lot of the serious issues that come up here?
I don't think a local law can.
Well, I mean, would international law have to be created to actually deal with these issues? And is that plausible?
It will eventually. There are serious problems, and people are worrying about it. I've helped organize a conference just dealing with the financial transfers because we thought that the banks had the highest interest in trying to harmonize the international laws because the financial data carries a very high value.
And presumably there's
already
a precedent.
It's extremely difficult to achieve because the although in many cases, as far as the criminal law is concerned, the law has to read exactly the same in both jurisdictions if you're going to get be able to get at the person who committed the criminal act. And that's very difficult because most of the laws, even if they sound like they're the same, have very different requirements.
I guess the banks are probably a good place to start since they already are used to international rules of some sort.
Well, they have their own SWIFT system in which they do establish the rules on the exchange of financial data within that system, and it's a very secure system. I went to visit Cable and Wireless, I guess it is, in Hong Kong, in which the SWIFT node is occupied, and you can't get anywhere near it.
I heard an attorney from Prodigy say in another session that the way they propose to deal with libel and defamation issues is to allow the aggrieved party access to the forum to rebut, you know, whatever the allegedly libelous statement was. And it, you know, my familiarity is that there aren't any legal cases that either, you know, bless that or you know, disallow it. Do you have a sense of what's coming, or what's your reaction to that?
Well, it's interesting. Florida, I guess, passed a law some years ago requiring that newspapers provide a right to reply. The Supreme Court held that was unconstitutional. Although, in fact, we do have a right to reply for personal attacks on broadcasting systems. Section 315, I guess it is, of the Federal Communications Act does require that if a personal attack is made on a broadcasting system.
Is a BBS a broadcast system?
No, it's not. I'm just saying that these are these are two different models, one for the newspaper and one for the broadcaster, which are quite different.
Right.
How we would come down in our society on the. I think again, we're in a stage in which we are developing the rules of what we think makes sense. Prodigy has made a decision that offering a right to reply is a good mechanism for resolving that particular controversy. And it may very well be. So I think as a bulletin board operator, you might make that decision. Well, is this a way of offering some way of resolving the controversy between the parties?
Do you have a personal belief as to whether that's a good mechanism? Or
seems a reasonable one. It depends upon how much. Well, I mean, part of the problem is whether the people who heard the original libelous statement will hear the reply. It's more likely that they'll hear the reply in the environment in which it was originally made. So, I mean, if it's not something in which lots of dollars are involved, it may be that the reply, an opportunity to explain why the statement is incorrect, may completely satisfy the person who was libeled. If a great deal of money is involved, it's more likely to end up in the courts, I think. Right. No, I realize that. So we've got two more questions, and then we'll call it quits.
Most of the talk centered around BBSs and like Echo, Fido, Mail things. How does Usenet come into this? It seems like a lot of the things you've talked about there's no way to apply many of those mechanisms to Usenet. More and more BBSs have Usenet news groups in them.
I'm not sure I'm familiar enough using
messages coming in from across the around the world, basically from other systems coming into a BBS system. How do you control those standards?
Yeah, we're talking 4,000 or 5,000 groups
from
most of the computers on internet.
I'm not aware of any litigation that has arisen with respect to Usenet groups. Are you, David? So I mean, it seems to me that as long as the users are satisfied with what they're getting. You don't get into the legal system. It's only when someone feels that their rights have been infringed, or that they excuse me.
Could I try to clarify something? The controls that one has on a bulletin board system, where you don't get access to it unless you log in, for example, are one kind.
Why don't you go to the microphone so everybody can hear you? Because I think this is an important point.
Some specifics, Anne, because you really will have an opinion, I think, when you realize what the issue is. The bulletin board systems that commonly allow people to log in first before they get access to the facilities allow the SysOp a primary filter on who is using the resources and who is injecting mail into the system or reading it. The problem is that when they interconnect to the Internet or Usenet or some of the other systems, they have no control over the influx of mail or the origination of mail in the system. So this stuff appears essentially out of the ether, and lands in the system. They have no control over who sent it. They have no idea, in some cases, who sent it. And the only thing they have is the people who log in to look at it, or they have some control over who gets to see it. They have no control over who sent it. So their concern over liability is that they don't have very much to say about who got in to inject the traffic into the system because of these new connections. Is that the basic problem? Okay, so how do they protect themselves?
It just seems that it's a really massive system that exchanges incredible amounts of opinions back and forth every day, and it's been going. I've been using it for 4 or 5 years, and like you say, I've never heard of any litigation or anything like that coming out of it. And I find that sort of amazing, but I have to wonder if that's because who would you go to?
Who would you go to?
I mean, it seems like the BBSs are being held up to a different standard because there's somebody to go to. There's somebody to sue.
Well, I mean, that's the question I'm raising with anonymity. I mean, how do you establish responsibility in a legal sense unless you do know to whom to go to hold responsible. I'm going to duck the question on the Usenet specifically because I haven't had enough familiarity with it except to say that so long as the system seems to work, it seems to me that there's no question. I mean, there's no litigable question to address.
Well, if an incoming message were deemed to be libelous by a third party,
this will be the last question.
Yeah, so that relates to my question. If the sysops generally together, who were both connecting to the internet and generally operating systems that allow traffic, were to agree among themselves on what standard of care they think is reasonable to take with regard to incoming Usenet messages and anonymity of users and so forth, do you think that that agreement would itself have legal significance in application under the territorial laws as a measure of the appropriate standard of care?
I would think so. Yeah, I mean, let's just say that I think as long as you have agreement, that's really the message that I'm trying to leave, is that I think you can't just sort of look out and say, well, you know, what are the dangers from the outside system? You have to develop your own rules and regulations that you would like to operate and feel that are fair, because this is a different environment. It's not the same as a newspaper. It's not the same as a broadcaster. It's not the same as a telephone company. But you're going to be competing with all of these entities and having to deal with the rules that they have used. So if you want a different set of rules, you're going to have to start promulgating them on your own and saying, this is the kind of electronic environment we want. These are the advantages of this system that are different and better than any other form of communication. Thank you.